Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. The podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology, including vision, cameras, and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello, and welcome to the Soda.ai Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Alexander Hirner, who's the CTO and co-founder at Moon Vision. Alex, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Yeah, great to be with you for your exciting project. Thanks.
Nice. Good to have you. So, Alex, I suppose, look, before we jump too much into Moon Vision and this tracker and everything exciting about computer vision that you're working on, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what kind of road or path you took before being the CTO of Moon Vision?
Sure. So I guess I'm kind of outlier in the spectrum of young kids, because I always was fascinated by self-replicating machines. So sort of like autonomous machines, and you bring them to life. So in my early childhood days, that naturally brought me to programming, and while others played football, I basically programmed viruses, these sorts of, quite programming heavy tasks. And then throughout the technical college, I basically studied electrical engineering, and then continued to work as an electrical engineer, embedded systems, for a couple of years. The whole AI thing was not mature at this point. So there were control systems. There was like fuzzy logic was the highest level of abstraction you could ask a system to reason with. That was what I was doing. But this was a long time ago. At a certain point in my career, I decided I need to see the world. I've not connected with all the things that are out there to explore in this narrow profession, and took on an MBA program, had saved enough time and experience, and went abroad to several continents, study abroad. And when I was on the West Coast in 2015, I believe, then I met like-minded people. So before that, I founded a blockchain meetup, Ethereum meetup here in Vienna, Austria. And by that, I got to know various other, let's say, inspiring persons. Through that, on the West Coast, I got to know people that truly already were on the rising summer tide of AI and machine learning. And so I joined them. I worked with the California Policy Research Center there on some OCR extraction tasks, and really got together in a good self-study group there. And we went through papers from Schmidhuber and colleagues, and studied them and implemented them. And it really gave me something special, because now I thought, it's the time that this technology becomes viable.
And you weren't one of the early buyers of Ethereum and Bitcoin by any chance, were you?
Yeah. In terms of investment, no, because I don't like this aspect of the scene. That's why I also stopped doing that. So after the meetup reached 1,000 people around that, I then moved to the US, and a colleague continued, and I've never invested large amounts. It basically financed my semester abroad, but for sure not something that others were making. And I'm quite happy with that, because from constraints, there comes the real solutions. The real innovation comes from constraints, I believe.
Not like that guy who accidentally paid for Bitcoin for his pizza for $40 like 10 years ago. And I think it's worth $3 million or something.
Right. And so if you never speculate, you can never become lazy, because you have everything, and you can never grieve. You didn't take the chance. So that's why I'm not speculating on this side.
So then you co-founded the Moon Vision. Tell me about what was that like? Where were you?
Right.
Were you seeing the idea? How did the idea come to formation?
Right.
What happened?
So in 2016, when I came back, a colleague that I met on a meetup, he contacted me and said, there is a hackathon and it's a large automotive company. And I think you are the guy that can help us to bring a solution with machine learning to them. And I said, no, writing the thesis, I don't want, what should we gain from that? And I said, yeah, maybe it helps with my thesis and so on. So, okay, let's join this hackathon. And it was at Audi in Ingolstadt. And our solutions was to distinguish containers by their looks in a few-shot classification scenario. So because they cannot count it automatically, they have to send people through their warehouses to count. We showed in a live setting that, hey, you can automate that with little training data. And that convinced the jury, and we've won this hackathon in 2016. And this brought us together as a team a little bit, but that was only the starting point of what we all didn't know would happen next. So that one prize was to go to visit an ice rally challenge with Audi cars in Finland. And we did that. And one evening, an older guy sat next to us and asked, hey, you guys, you don't fit the regular crowd here because you're too young. You cannot afford these kind of trainings. What do you do? And we said, yeah, you're right. We are nerds. We've won the hackathon and with a cool solution. And then he asks, okay, if you can do that with container, can you do it with chicken too? And we said, what? Why? What do you mean? And then it turns out he's a restaurant, an owner of a tent at the Oktoberfest Munich.
Excellent.
And he has the problem over years and many others too, that the checkout process needs to be controlled by trusted people. Otherwise, too much food leaves the kitchen that is not put into the cash register.
That is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And so he said, okay, so are you up to the challenge? And we said, okay, well, yes, let's do it. Let's make this thing happening. Have had not much experience with object detection at this point in time, more of the image classification side. But well, we had some preparation time and we already knew exactly what the challenges are regarding training data and preparation of this. So we had 4 months to prepare everything and then put the system live. And then we had to be very rapid in the setup of the system. And yeah, it worked out.
That's a really, really cool, really cool founder story. Okay. So what applications then are you using? So you've mentioned, you can count containers, detect containers. You then met a guy who runs the tents at Oktoberfest. You can see what's on a plate and say, yeah, look, we've got a burger, we've got chips, we've got fish. Where else are you using computer vision?
Right, so we use tracking, object detection, and visual classification mainly. The other parts to determine areas of quality, we do with segmentation, and we combine that also into instant segmentation tasks. And all these techniques are now abstracted and generic, but they of course boil down to specific use cases. And what sticks to our DNA and goes with our DNA is the rapid generation of qualified training data from cheap input signals. So we go from video to suitable training data to suitable algorithms like supervised trainings very quickly.
And you mentioned as well, you also in the QA side of things, how are you using computer vision for quality?
So it's mainly the same schema what we do. So every solution consists of counting and or quality judgments. Specifically, what are the most fruitful areas and application areas for learning systems, not for hand-tuned or where you create your cascades of filters by hand, but they are learned, are applications where there is dispute amongst experts, which means that if expert A in Ireland looks on a sheet of wooden surface and he would say, hey, this area I cannot use in the interior of my car, this I can, then there can be other experts in Germany that don't agree. And this is the perfect setting for an AI, because it's a complex and subjective visual task. And this is where the main areas are. So in quality judgments of natural surfaces, be it in leather, in wood, in streets, this is where we have had and had a lot of successful projects. And we build out our platform and training data and algorithms.
Cool. So building out the applications, I guess you'd use a range of deep learning, computer vision technologies and cameras. I suppose if we kind of tick through these and kind of say where they're coming in and how big of an impact each individual one is playing on your product, and kind of learn a bit more how you're using them. How did you start? Did you start with cameras? Did you start with images that people were providing you? Did you take the images? And then how you progressed from, I suppose, maybe whatever way you took it, to then introducing computer vision, to then introducing deep learning?
Right. So one thing you really have to be, if you are making a system, if you're making a system with guarantees, you need to control or own the data acquisition pipeline, the mode, how you set up, how you filter at least the raw input signal. That's very important. And so, for example, you can always start with cheap video from any signal, but how can you select the training frames that are relevant? So that's the software side of things. And throughout our projects, we have used many cameras, and what we started with was a classical Raspberry Pi B plus an Sony IMX 219, I think, like the regular V2 camera. And we mounted that on the Oktoberfest tent. So there was, I went up there, screwed them on, and written a small TCP server that streamed the video into the GPU machine. From that, we've abstracted away the video input layers, and we are basically compatible with machine vision cameras through the GeniCam standard, USB cameras, IP cameras via different protocols over the web or over sockets. And of course, in areas where you need lighting setup to even make a decision, that is part of the full solution, but we don't design them. So we are not the experts to set up the lighting such that scratch will be clear in the brightness information of an image.
I guess that was probably a tough weekend, having to go to Oktoberfest and see if your software is working.
I bet you. Yes, it was. It was the maximum level of uncertainty what's going to happen. Yes,
I can imagine it being very fun and very stressful, and then just at the end of it, it's like, thank God that's over, because it'd be very rewarding. One of them things that, you know, you love to see, but you also love to see it end.
Yeah, so if you see it working, it's okay if it doesn't end. So we had a lot of fun, obviously. Also the last days when the system was set up, we had one more training rounds afterwards, due to the false positives of the hair structure of some persons, they're causing false positives. And afterwards, there was a fine further week of celebrating, basically.
I mean, mean, it was kind of a trial by fire, right? You went into what would be probably one of the busiest events across Germany, if not the busiest event across Germany. You're guaranteeing every person there is going to eat something at some point in the day as well, right? So it's a lot. What were your biggest learnings and takeaways from your first trial run? Because I guess you wouldn't have had much research time for this.
Right. So it was in March when we accepted the challenge, and still we didn't know if it would become a company, but it was more of a solo project with, yeah, then took in some front-end help with it. But basically, the 4 months, you had to be very clear what is the real bottleneck. And the real bottleneck is you don't know which objects you have to locate and categorize up to 2 days when the meals are prepared. And you have you have nothing. And in 2017, there were no labeling platforms. Not really for object detection, not really multi-user, not really with helping functions where you can check the consistency of categories. So that was the tooling around it, from video to scene extraction to unsupervised algorithms that pick out roundish objects already and presenting it all in a labeling tool interface that can be used from, we had one person in Vienna and one at the Oktoberfest booth working together. That was the ingredient that made it really work out. And yeah, and with that's some core things that have been built in 4 months. Recommendation system, video extraction, automatic pre-labeling, and quality control of labeled entities. Yes. That was the key, yeah.
So we talked then as well. So it's quite interesting because you would have had these running on an edge device. You had a GPU, which you would have brought with you. Probably not even computer vision standard when you go back 3 months ago, or 3 years ago, sorry, that people were running algorithms on edge devices. What was your kind of learns from back then? And I suppose, how did you start on edge devices, and how has it changed to now?
Right. I have to make a correction, though. The actual compute happened on a GPU machine. So what we did, we streamed in 3 points of checkouts with the video signal being transmitted over network, but into the GPU machine. So that was not embedded computer vision. The Raspberry Pi would not be able to have the tracking part on its CPU, and also the accelerations are not, the software for the acceleration drivers are not there. So we did use NVIDIA GPUs.
Nice. No, it's good. And right. So you compare that to Oktoberfest 3 years ago to, well, there wasn't Oktoberfest this year.
Right.
So maybe last year, what has changed? What does it look like now?
Right. Right now, it's a standard process, and where we begin is having pre-trained models do all the critical data extraction much more accurate, and have a fine-tuning process that needs 1/10 of the data to begin with. That's basically has changed, and also the data exchange pipelines are now fully global, that means in the internet and with the always on platform. And yeah, it's a whole, like, a platform that stores all the data and models of last year. And then it's just whatever you've done once, the second time you're twice as fast, and that continues.
One thing as well, you've actually even mentioned already, but on data annotation, it's one thing that I find isn't talked about a lot in computer vision, particularly when you compare even Europe to San Francisco, the Bay Area. They have data annotation engineers, so they're special engineers who are there to build data annotation pipelines, which is something that I think there's maybe one or two companies across Germany that I've seen that have one or maybe even two of these guys. But you had to look at this annotation process 2 days' notice, before you know what's on the menu. How did you annotate the data? How did you do it? You know, it's quite a short timeline. You didn't have a lot of time to make it work, but it's been still there.
Right. Well, you have to exactly know the strengths and weaknesses of the algorithm that finally predicts or gives you the desired prediction. And so, you know, in an object detection sense, you want complete annotation. So not weakly supervised, but all the objects that are of this class. So it must be complete. The second one is, do you want or depend on motion blurred scenes in such a way that the human can know the item because two frames ago it was not motion blurred? No, you don't want that. You want a prediction on an isolated image. And that's how your training data should look like. And that's how your tooling should be set up. So we started with like raw video, then the algorithm selects videos where lots of stuff has been moved in between, but doesn't include movement so much. That means less motion blur. And you start from these frames. And then we've made an algorithm, the unsupervised object detection, that picks out round items. You start from there, and so in order not to miss anything and to speed up the drawing of shapes. The next point is you have to make the shape drawing fit well to your domain. So if you have something like self-driving car, you probably want a magic lasso where the Vector Institute guys are quite good at. So you draw an approximate shape and it snaps into the right places. For us in the beginning, it was circles because food is round and it takes you less clicks. Then eventually you have to parallelize the annotation work. And we did it in such a way that the labels that one person provides will be the recommendation of the next person within the same instant. So by that, you avoid a drift in the concept of what is to be annotated because it's synchronized by the recommendations of the system. And finally, you'd want to have a feedback channel from the model, from the trained model. What are the false positives, the false negatives, and you will find labeling mistakes that you didn't expect. And then you get rid of them and this cycle continues and then you're done.
Nice. Yeah. So look, you explain it very well and make it seem quite simple, but you know, you would need to take into consideration the little bit of time you had to do it as well. Was that a bit of an all hands on deck moment? Would you say that's a moment that would have, you know, even defined the company, because you just had 2 days to make it work? It was make or break, really, was it?
Yes.
Nice, and here you are. So that's the process of how you annotated it. One thing as well that you're quite big on is Q&A, making sure that everything goes in well from the Q&A process of annotated data right through to model inspection. Mm-hmm. You want to touch on those probably in order if we go back to how you Q&A the annotation data pipeline, and then we'll touch a little bit on model inspection then.
Right. So the annotation Q&A touched upon a little bit. This was the Oktoberfest times. We now have pipeline that combines model introspection and model and data QA. And this is essential. So quantifying the uncertainty of any prediction is the holy grail. And why? Because if you have a model be able to say what it doesn't know, you can always teach it. You can most often teach it. And if it's impossible to get more predictions, then at least you have a certain outcome eventually. You have fallback mechanisms. So model introspection in this sense means, yes, it has to be an open set recognition problem for classification. And yes, you have to, for other techniques, you have to also quantify either pixel-wise correct the uncertainty. And this can guide your data gathering process. So that's basically classical active learning way of thinking. You make predictions, you say, is it worthwhile to reconsider this as training data, include it in the training data, improve the model? There is a moment of production readiness, and this happened a lot in industrial applications, in quality assurance, and in counting tasks like containers and dish tracker, where the model is on average is the average intelligence of any expert. And in some cases, that means it's more accurate than the expert. And then you can really trust the system that if you input new data for validation purposes and so on, you can really almost rely on that any false prediction is something new or wrongly labeled. And then you've basically won. So if you have this pipeline in place and you have reached a certain production ready level, then it's easy to adapt to small shifts in domain and so on. And this is what you want to reach. And the cold start problem is the problem, basically, the real problem.
Yes, good. And I suppose when it comes to a lot of people doing model inspection, or even the models, you know, what's the most common failures that you've seen or even that you've experienced?
Failures due to underlying reasons or failures that were in hindsight not of a particular failure in the modeling or data? Because that's two different things. Failures in data preparation can be you filter out some annotations inadvertently and then you have false negatives and you just don't realize it's a typo, those sorts of bugs. The unexpected or in hindsight harder to explain errors are something we are still on and have to be on our toes until there's really a stable system and a customized system. And those failures are usually due to overfitting that you don't know of, sort of in this way. So the model pays attention to features that you didn't think a shortcut exists. So, I mean, everyone knows the story about the military in the US sourced a solution to classify, is it a tank or a car? And it was super correct, their predictions. Then they realized all the tanks have been filmed at a certain day of time where the shadow was in a certain direction and the car is in another one. So it didn't work in the real, right? So this is kind of,
Yeah.
We've been there. Yeah, we know that. And here you need some sort of qualitative answer of your model because you don't have quantities that you can rely on if the outcome is a clean prediction. So here the attention mechanisms are really helpful.
That's really cool. I know a lot of issues like that, and I suppose a lot of companies take it into, you know, depending what your product is, it can be weather related. I can't remember. So there was a story of one, and it wouldn't say what was because everything that they done was never basically in snow, and then there was snow and everything was white. The algorithm just wasn't working.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So that sounds similar to taking shortcuts that you didn't, as a data engineer, research engineer, didn't expect.
Yeah. So look, I suppose this. That's a good way to finish that off, and you know, shortcuts that research engineers don't expect. So if we talk about what you say machine learning in the wild, so is going from research to production.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've done research to production in 4 months. I've also seen people go from research to production in 4 years. So look, from your experience, you know, you managed to get something built up and working, and you tested very fast, in my opinion. You know, what can be, or what makes going from research to production so difficult?
Yeah. So in research, of what I want to say first is we are a huge beneficiary of the research, both in terms of libraries, open source, starting from PyTorch and its ecosystem, and to research papers that tackle interesting ways that we can combine with the practical approach. The combination is the thing that's missing. So in practice, the problems come in a combined fashion. In academic research, they come in isolation. So you have noisy labels for image classification. There are papers for how to best deal with noisy labels. Same for balanced versus unbalanced data sets. Same for fine-grained classification tasks, given a differently fine-grained training set or test set. Same for domain shifts. So you have in all of these, it's four practically relevant fields. You have benchmarks and very smart approaches and sometimes very complicated and meaningless approaches. But anyway, there is measurable progress. In practice, you have noisy labels, unbalanced data, mismatch between the fine-grainedness between test and train, and domain shifts all at once. So what this means is that you want some, for example, hard example mining to balance the easy from the hard, the frequent from the non-hard, to have that in your model. But you also have maybe labeling mistakes. So what you actually learn also are hard and wrong examples, and you learn them very rigorously. And this is not the full solution, because you don't want to learn a hard example very rigorously if it's wrong. And there are no good answers in the academia, but there are good answers in practice. And in practice, you would have the human in the loop, and you would iterate. You would iterate on your data, and this is usually not the way how academia is set up. Yeah, there are oracles that kind of emulate active learning, but it's by far a less heavyweight field than the combination of these problems. Yeah.
Do you think, I suppose, look, if we're talking about overcoming it, do you think people from academia or people who are doing research of a product just really need to not be afraid of failure, or where can they really come in and make a difference?
It's a good question.
Yeah, what's the best advice, I suppose, is what I'm saying, you would give to someone who's trying to productionize something that is purely research focused for the moment?
My first advice would be make a system end-to-end that you care about, and be responsible for sourcing and transforming the data. This will give you intuitions and ideas that probably are outside of what you could achieve with pre-setup challenges. Or in a purely academic context, get involved with making benchmarks. So there's a very interesting, like for our domain, a challenge that just came out this year. I think it was a little bit inspired by Google's Open Objects data set version 4. And that's the Elvis challenge. Yes, I'm looking it up. Yes, the Elvis challenge, which has partially labeled data for instant segmentation object detection. And I have no like true insights, because I'm not on the working group of these like who created it, but you can clearly see that this is a good step into the right direction of practicality. Other good, purely academic efforts, other continuous learning group. I think in Italy there's one very active group that comes up with challenges of, hey, you don't have all the historical data all the time, still you want to evolve your model. Now solve it. And it's still early. So pick those fields that branch off from the mainstream and are in somewhat and have a feedback loop to the data somehow included, or are impartial, or are in some way imperfect, like our world is. That would be, those things I would highly recommend.
Excellent. Well, Alex, look, I think that's us in terms of time and what we planned on going through. So closing off for everyone listening, this is the Soda.ai Computer Vision and Production Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest was Alexander Herner, who is the CTO and co-founder at The Moon Vision. Alex, great to have you on the show. Thank you for being such a great guest.
Anthony, it was my pleasure. Thanks, and lots of more of the successes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.